Hello and welcome to as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 21st of June 2015. My name's TRP Watson. This week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Phil from the West End Whingers, Nick from Pastor's Destructive View, and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about An Audience with Jimmy Savile by Jonathan Maitland. This contains research from the book In Plain Sight by Dan Davis. It's directed by Brendan O'Hay at the Park Theatre, and it has a cast that includes Alistair McGowan as Jimmy Savile, Charlotte Page, Lee Whittaker, Robert Perkins, and Graham Seed. Graham Seed, of course, was in Dead Sheep earlier this year, which was Jonathan Maitland's first play ever, I think, and his most recent play at the Park Theatre only a few months ago, so he seems to be a bit on a roll with playwriting at the moment. This play is set in about 1991, just after Jimmy Savile has been knighted, and I think it's a fictional version of a tribute show to Jimmy Savile. We see that as a framing device here, and really they're telling Jimmy Savile's life, and we're also getting the stirrings of the sexual abuse inquiries that popped up every now and again with Jimmy Savile, but were never resolved and certainly never went to court. We see the way that he protected himself and in many ways denied that he was ever doing anything wrong. There is a parallel story here as a young woman abused in the late 70s by Jimmy Savile is not only trying to come to terms with it, especially as she has a daughter about the same age as she was when she was abused, and not only trying to come to terms with it, but trying to talk about it to the papers, to the police, trying to get them to do something about it. And whenever people go back and try to confront Jimmy Savile with the ideas that he might have done something wrong, start gathering evidence of his wrongdoing, he always comes back and says, "I will sue, I've got important lawyers, and you could lose everything, and I will go after you even if you're a police officer." And people were intimidated by it. But we get this sense of this man who does seem to be a deeply horrible man, and there is that question we have of Jimmy Savile, is why didn't we get him? Why didn't we catch up with him? It's always said, well, he was being protected, but nobody would have protected him if enough people had spoken out. But I think that everybody connected with it, you know, even if you thought there was something dodgy going on, you're saying, it's not worth me doing it because I won't be able to stand up with it on my own. As a group, as a mob, if they'd known how many people there were behind this, he would have gone down very quickly and probably 20 years before, in the early 70s, he probably would have been jailed. Well, one hopes he would have been. And there is always that nasty feeling that there are people who knew exactly what he was doing and were protecting him. I think what this play seems to show is that people sort of knew what he was doing but preferred not to think about it, or that they thought, well, I'm the only one, and I can't, if I complain, everybody else is going to join ranks against me and Jimmy Savile will be protected. Because obviously he was this great fundraiser, and that sort of gave him a lot of protection. And in some ways this play suggests that perhaps that it was his own form of atonement, and yes, almost a kind of absolution for his sins. I mean, he was knighted by the Catholic Church in, I think, the late 70s or early 80s, so they were very much on side with him. I mean, now we have a sort of a 2020 feeling with Jimmy Savile, so everything you see is very disturbing. And what we get here in this play, we get, especially from Alistair McGowan as Jimmy Savile, you get this, it's not an impersonation because he would have, it's because it's not quite accurate, or it's not quite the impersonation that you would normally expect from an impressionist, which is what Alistair McGowan is best known for. This is, I think, a much better study of him, and a much more in-depth one. And actually, there were times, certainly to begin with, I thought, well, he's not really being Savile, is he? He's being something else. But overall, you do get that. I don't think you ever get the charm of Savile, because that's what we saw when we watched him on television, you know, doing Jim Will Fix It or doing other things. to begin with, certainly up until later on in his life, until maybe the 2000s, you got Jimmy Savile, who was, he was portrayed as this very charming, this very fun person. And what you get here is a much more of what he may have been like underneath, what he would have been when he wasn't on camera. And you get some very disturbing things where he almost hides in plain sight and says things, you know, about having lots of sex with women and telling his best friend not to grass on him. And you suddenly get the feeling, well, what he's really doing is saying, yeah, really don't grass on me. Really don't go into my sex life too much, because that he has got something to hide. I found this a deeply disturbing play. Although it was it is extremely well done, and I think it's a very good play, but I did find it disturbing, and almost you didn't feel like clapping at the end of it, because it stirred you up, and you just wished that, you know, he could have been found out and something could have been done, because he does seem to have been this genuinely horrible person. And if he was protected, that's awful. And if he was able to build up a carapace of self-protection, which the play more suggests that than some kind of big high-up government paedophile conspiracy, which is sometimes what is touted. It's more that he got to a position where he could be indiscreet and threaten people just enough that they would think that they couldn't get away with it. With the parallel story, we do get a little bit of wish fulfillment. I always think this is the problem with people trying to do a Margaret Thatcher play, that you would need somebody in there to prove that Thatcher was wrong, and there was never that person while she was alive. I mean, we got close in Jonathan Maitland's last play with the idea of the dead sheep, of the idea of Geoffrey Howe coming back to haunt Thatcher. But with Thatcher, we never got that sort of satisfaction of everybody telling her how wrong she was and somebody actually convincing her that she was wrong. And we do get a little bit of wish fulfillment here, where we do have a scene which is presumably imagined, where he is confronted by one of his victims, and we get all his denial and the easy excuses he makes. You know, they are after money, I am famous, and that's what they're after. They are all liars, they're all sluts and stuff like that. And we get to see that denial, and we get to see the sort of the debate where it comes in his religious feelings, and that's imagined. And I think that's really the only bit I found wrong with this play, because it's wish fulfillment. It's 2020 hindsight. You know, if only we knew then what we know now. Well, you know, obviously people did know what was going on then, but it's like having an argument with a gravestone. They can't answer back. You can't really know the truth, and it's a thing that sort of makes you angry, because you wish you could have done this, and the play fulfills that wish, but it doesn't really fit the drama. It doesn't really fit the truth of it, I thought. But overall, I think this is an excellent play, if very disturbing. John, what did you think about it?
I don't want to turn this into a debate about the Jimmy Savile history, because, you know, we can't know. And I think what a lot of people ignore, and Jonathan Maitland actually does capture it in a very good sense of the period, is how different mores were in those days. You know, I wasn't a 15-year-old girl in 1970, but I knew a lot of them. And I'm fairly sure that the power of Top of the Pops was such that if Dave Lee Travis or Simon D or even Jimmy Savile had, you know, raised an eyebrow, they would have flocked to him. And it was kind of quite a popular ambition to shag a DJ. So it is understandable, if you like, that people in those sorts of early television huge popularity positions commanded a kind of mystique and an aura around them that they wouldn't get now, because there is also the internet. There are also many more channels in which dissent from that can be discussed. And you know, you were saying, if only more girls had spoken up, if only people had been able to come together. I am hopeful that nowadays, should such a dreadful situation arise again, we would hear about it, and more people would take notice. So, you know, the world has moved on, and people are perhaps better protected from this. Because, of course, you know, rape is the ultimate unwitnessable crime. Nobody can corroborate it apart from the two people involved. It's consistently a difficult thing. And also, of course, you're right that the interesting shadow behind Jimmy Savile's public, jolly, Father Christmas-like persona in Jim will fix it for you to swim with dolphins or dance with the Royal Ballet or meet the Queen or whatever it was that the kids wrote into the programme to ask for, and he appeared, or his production team appeared to deliver, is this kind of sinister edge, which I also think Maitland has captured very well, and the fact that Savile's not biggest friend necessarily, because he tended to refer to people as friends when he really meant they're in my employ, was the famous libel lawyer George Carman, who had first defended Jeremy Thorpe and then also successfully supported Elton John in a big and famous libel case. And in fact, I think possibly the one that said he was gay. Oh, how interesting. But more significantly, an actor called Peter Adamson, who played Len Fairclough in Coronation Street and was accused of interfering with young girls who he was teaching to swim in a swimming bath in Rochdale, where he was a volunteer lifeguard. And Carman got him off when people said, perhaps with hindsight, but certainly a lot of people at the time believed that Adamson was guilty. And also, in a name in the news at the moment, Greville Janner, Carman defended him at the time he was actually accused of the cases that are now being brought to light afresh when he's claimed to be too unwell and mentally defective to defend them. Anyway, that's all history. What we should be talking about perhaps more is about drama and theatre, and that this extraordinary man and his extraordinary acts have been brought to life in what I think are two pieces of extraordinary bravery. Jez Bond, the artistic director of the Park Theatre, putting his and his theatre's reputation on the line in developing something like this. And Alistair McGowan for lending his immaculate skills as an impressionist to what is really the portrayal of a beast. And as you pointed out, Tim, you know, for Jonathan Maitland, it's second time around for staging here at the Park a living portrait of a character who was very much monstered by the popular press, because Dead Sheep, as you say, is a first-rate impressionist. It was Steve Nallon from Spitting Image playing Mrs. Thatcher in a documentary drama about the late days of her premiership. So I'm not sure what Jonathan Maitland has his eyes on next. I'd kind of recommend John Coleshill to play Sepp Blatter in a new drama about FIFA. It'd be a great trilogy of plays about dreadful people. But the thing that, for me, gave the play a really urgent and heightened credibility was Maitland's ear for documentary dialogue. It really is faultless. This sounds like the people are talking to you. And that's really why you feel so uncomfortable and you feel so awkward in the presence of Savile, not just because Alistair McGowan has made such a perfect impression of it, but because the words put in his mouth by Maitland's script are, again, they sound so realistic, even in circumstances where we wouldn't ever have witnessed what Savile was saying. Like, I think the constructed police interview is possibly one of the best scenes in this play, where the detective so nearly gets to the truth and Savile just blusters his way out of it at the last minute. The other personality that I think perhaps Maitland could have made a bit more of, really, very reliable and excellent actor Graham Seed, playing the chat show host. I don't know if they fought shy of this, perhaps because the man's still alive, but you know, he really is just one free Parker pen shy of the full Michael Parkinson. And I think they should have made it Michael Parkinson. I think it should have been a little bit more Yorkshire and a little bit more accurately him confronting and interviewing Savile, because he's been interviewed separately saying, you know, he hated Jimmy Savile and sort of knew what he was on about all the time. But I'm not sure that's actually consistent with what happened in the 80s. I also felt that in the structure of the play, we were a little bit short of characters. I think that Graham Seed as the TV show host really needed another TV executive character. There was a little conversation with his producer, but it wasn't, it wasn't the head of ITV. I can't remember who the other character was. But I think it needed more characters who were TV executives to actually debate the dilemmas broadcasters wrestled with when considering whether to confront him. Because there obviously was gossip, if nothing more evidential than that, about incidents in dressing rooms. And in fact, one of those it's reported rather than acted out. But there is a situation where someone says Jimmy's got a girl in the dressing room kind of thing. So I think, like I said, I think Maitland got that very right. It's very good at evoking the period and evoking the sense of danger in accusing a beloved celebrity, because you cannot underestimate how popular he was. I didn't like Jimmy Savile. I didn't like watching him on television because I thought he was brash and crude and unfunny compared to perhaps the, you know, more Pythonesque kind of comedians that I gravitated towards in my teenage years. But undoubtedly, he had the kind of popular following whose downfall would have been resisted by a general public that actually makes, I don't know, Jeremy Clarkson look like a leper. Really, you would not have been able to say or do anything against Jimmy Savile unless you had a real welter of evidence to condemn him. So I think the piece is as even-handed as hindsight allows. You know, it fairly mentions that the £40 million Jimmy Savile raised for charities, the hospitals he rescued from closure and the lives he saved by fronting the clunk click every trip seatbelt campaign. The man did a lot of good. And you interestingly say that, you know, that there is this weighing in the balance of whether what he did, you know, running marathons for charity, outweighed what he did in terms of hurting young women. And I don't think you can weigh the two things in the same balance. And I hope that one of the issues coming out of the play is that you can't do that, that you must assess people for their crimes independently of anything that represents a credit side to their activities. I think Alistair McGowan's performance is mesmerising. He convinced me both as the kind of adulation junkie who played up his own, what's the phrase he used, the power of odd, the celebration of odd, that Jimmy Savile himself says about his own quirkiness. He made it a trademark. But also, McGowan is very good in how gradually he releases this seditious, controlling and vicious side, and perhaps suggests that supports his ultimate guilt. But when he is playing angry or playing creepy, you really can feel it. And it's a tribute to his skills that he is not just a very good impressionist, but he's a very capable actor as well. And those two things don't often go together, because impressionists generally work in a more sketch-like format rather than full-length plays. The thing that really made the hairs rise on the back of my neck in creepiness was his scathing condemnation of his victims as money-grubbing scroungers or immoral sluts. I saw this on the same day that the news media reported that Rolf Harris had composed exactly those same reactions and feelings into a song he'd written in prison. It just felt awful. The severity of the crimes, as you kind of suggested, does mean that the audience doesn't relax, which is a shame, because there is a lot of humour in the structure and the scripting of this play to be enjoyed. And audiences don't tend to warm to that, or certainly not laugh and applaud to it, for fear of being seen to be giving approbation to the character of Savile himself. And that, again, it's a tribute to the fact that McGowan completely inhabits the character as snugly and awfully as he wears his turquoise Lurex shell suit. Where I think they could perhaps reward the actor for his efforts better is if at the curtain call, instead of appearing in character, he just came out without the wig and in a dressing gown. And then I think he really would get the tremendous ovation he truly deserves. But I do think it's a great piece of work. I was surprised. Well, I think people were reacting to it even before it was staged, because there was a lot of pre-publicity about it. But it's only since it's opened that the audiences are really flocking to it, and most of the performances are already sold out, and they are scheduling extra ones. So whether it could go anywhere else from the park, I don't know, but it's certainly well worth a look. And I think, as I say, a very brave piece by everybody involved.
Just before we begin this review, the title of this play means that one or two F-bombs are dropped, and of course I also get the title of the play wrong, which doesn't help. We're now going to talk about Motherfucker in the Hat by Stephen Adly Gurgis. This is directed by Indu Rubishingam and stars Natalie Armin, Ricardo Chaviera, Alec Newman, Flor de Liz Perez and Yul Vasquez. It's about the third time we've had a major Stephen Adly Gurgis production in the last, well, decade or so. The first one I ever saw was Jesus Hopped the A-Train at the Donmar Warehouse, which was directed by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And there have been other productions such as In Arabia Would All Be Kings at the Hampstead Theatre and The Last Days of Judas Iscariot, which was done at the Almeida in 2008, I believe. This play concerns a Puerto Rican couple. The man has just come out of prison and is struggling with substance abuse. He has a, shall we say, tempestuous relationship with his girlfriend and discovers a hat in her flat and wants to know who the mofo is who was wearing that hat. Anyway, Phil, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, I'm going to correct you on the title. It's The Motherfucker with the Hat, Not in the Hat, just because it's a chance to swear on the blog, which I've never done, on the podcast, which I've never done before. And I just had a ball. I thought this was absolutely riveting. It's the best thing under Rufus Norris's since he's taken over, and it's just sort of the National kind of really back on form. It's really, really funny. The language, I think, you know, there is a clue in the title, is pretty ripe. It's very extreme. There's one line about a nun which had me gasping, and I will never forget that line. But also, it's not just funny. It's actually, it managed to switch between the humour and the dramatic moments very sharply. There's a fight scene towards the end, which I thought was fantastically well staged. Some people say it's not. It's a slightly sort of naff fight, but I think it's deliberately like that. And there's a sight gag in that, which just made me laugh out loud. It also, I think, as the story progresses, there are reveals in the story, one of which sort of has the audience gasping, which is always great to make the audience gasp. Well, I probably gasped as well because I just didn't see it coming. And it's beautifully staged. The sets are great. We switch between different apartments in the thing. There's three different sets. They're trolleys, but they sort of come on. They appear to float on as these floating fire escapes, which are lit up in red, revolve around with the changes. And just watching the scene changes, which are very quite quick, were a pleasure in itself. I can't think of anything bad to say about this production, apart from to say to people, you've really got to go and see it. It was about an hour and 50 minutes straight through when I saw it. I wasn't aware of time passing. There's absolutely excellent performances. Ricardo Chavira, I didn't realise he was in it until about the day before I went. He was Carlos in Desperate Housewives, as being a bit of a Desperate Housewives fan. It was great to see him. I don't think I would have recognised him without his Desperate Housewives goatee. He was a revelation for me. I thought he really was, he's sort of the solid centre of the play. And although the characters in it, they're a pretty nasty bunch of people, what they do to each other, you kind of somehow, Stephen Adley Gurgis has made you care about them. And they just interact so well. There are three of them are Americans. I couldn't tell which two were not Americans. It's actually Alec Newman and Natalie Armin. Their performance was so convincing as Americans, I really wouldn't know. And also, the complete scene stealer in the play, Yul Vasquez, as the cousin of Ricardo Chavira's character, who's this gay health food freak who serves up Dave Lowe health drinks. He just walked off with every scene. It's kind of a bit annoying when people's exits are applauded, but he was applauded, I think, on every exit the night I saw it. He got a Tony nomination for it when he did it on Broadway. He's the only one who's actually in it from the Broadway production. And he's just very hilarious, but it's the way he does it. You've just got to see it. I mean, I just can't think of anything bad to say about this. It doesn't even slip into mortgages. It's got quite a touching ending, and it manages to shy just the side of being mortgage. Just absolutely excellent. Really enjoyed it.
Nick, what did you think?
I can't argue with most of that. I think, you know, listing the previous shows of his that have played in London does kind of give you a sign of him, of Stephen Adley Gurgis just being very, having quite a lot of variety available to him in his writing, because those are quite different pieces. This is certainly the most full-on comedy of the plays of his that I've seen. And it's one of those where the dialogue within kind of a couple of lines of it starting, you feel really comfortable in it, but not in the sense that it's going to be cozy, because it's clearly, as everybody said, it does live up to the title. But you know you're in safe hands, and you know you've got a writer with a very distinct way of phrasing himself and very funny sensibility in his writing. And that doesn't flag in that respect, but as Phil says, it does also come in with a lot more kind of depth to it without becoming cheesy. So I agree that it's the best thing we've had at the National since Rufus Norris took over, and Indira Rubbersingham's a director I like, and I'm glad to see her kind of make a splash in her first production at the National. But it's really so well put together, it's so slickly done, there is very little to pick apart from it. I think Gareth was actually there the same night I was, so I don't know whether you thought the same.
I didn't know I was there the same night as you, but yes, I think it's great. I thought it was a little long, I have to say. I did think there were a few longueurs for me. I think he's got a very distinctive voice, and this kind of naturalistic dialogue that he puts together is not in the slightest way gratuitous. It's, of course, expletive written, but to me it was sort of, you know, it's necessary in the piece, really. I think it is his best of the four of his plays I've seen. It's certainly the funniest of the four of the plays I've seen. And it's almost as if you can kind of see him grow as a better playwright. He's not as prolific as some other playwrights, but I think this is unquestionably the best we've seen here in the UK. He's a kind of modern-day Mamet or Shepherd, but very distinctive. And what I mean by that is that in terms of the sort of, I suppose, the style of American writing. But it does here get this extraordinary production by Indu Rubbersingham, who is, I agree with Nick, who is a terrific director. And it's great to see her doing something at the National at last. And Ricardo Chavira just blew me away, really. I mean, I read in the programme that he'd done A Streetcar Named Desire in New York, and I thought, oh, God, I'd love to have seen that, because, I mean, I think he would just be brilliant as Stanley in that. But, I mean, you know, the scenes he has with Deliz Perez and with Alec Newman are just electrifying. I mean, they just play off each other so brilliantly, both. And as you say, you know, as you've said, these Yul Vasquez, or whatever you pronounce his surname, is he kind of brings this much more restrained performance in a much more restrained character, which really does add so much to the piece. So I thought it was great. I took my 30-year-old goddaughter to see it, which I'm sure isn't the sort of thing godfathers are supposed to take their goddaughters to, but what the hell. And she loved it as well, and absolutely to be recommended for me.
I didn't think it was going to be that kind of play that had so much sort of reveal, which just kept my interest. It was the more I thought about it, I came out thinking it's kind of four, but it's almost a five. And then the next day when I was thinking about it, I think it's so vivid in my mind, and also the look of it I thought was super. I mean, we were really lucky because we were sort of four rows back in the center, and it looked fantastic from there.
You said
those... I did wonder how good it would look from right at the back, whether it'd look a bit lost.
Yeah, because it's very, you know, once the sets are on, it's kept very much to the center. And I think from the sides at the front, it probably would be a bit of a problem because they're not using the whole stage. But
they did.
I mean, from where I was, again, sort of in the cheap seats at the front, it was great.
Yeah,
because it felt like the stage was being really used rather than. What was happening, which was a very small amount being used. But I wonder whether if you were right at the back of the circle, you'd be kind of looking at lots of vast empty spaces with people kind of
it's sort of needs a smaller theatre. But
those sets, though, I mean, they looked as if they were kind of being sort of gliding in on hydraulic arms rather than trolleys, because
it was so smooth.
And I think
I love the way they click together like sort of puzzle pieces.
That's right.
And they always look like the bits the flying in were going to hit the objects on the stage and never did. And that was, it was like a jigsaw kind of thing.
You don't often see it that well timed, do you? You normally kind of see the sliding bits will come in and then it will fly in once it's in place. But they all kind of clicked in from every direction.
Yeah.
The idea of sort of anchoring the play in New York with just three fire escapes, which I thought was just brilliant, really, because that's all you think about. When you think about fire escapes in New York, it's just perfect. It's a perfectly simple way of just saying this is where we are.
We're now going to talk about One Arm at the Southwark Playhouse. This is a play, it's originally a screenplay by Tennessee Williams, an unproduced screenplay by Tennessee Williams. In fact, I'm not sure it could ever be made into a film even now. But it was adapted by Moses Kaufman for, I think, the Steppenwolf Company in the 80s, and has been directed here by Josh Seymour with Peter Hanna, Joe Jameson, Georgia Kerr, James Tucker, and Tom Vary. It concerns a fighter, a boxer in the Navy who in a car accident loses his arm and becomes a hustler. And we meet him at first when he's on death row, expecting to die, and we get a look back at his life and what brought him to where he was. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, it's Tennessee Williams, and I'm a huge fan of Tennessee Williams, and I've seen a lot of his shorts. And I kind of went to the theatre expecting a Tennessee Williams short, really, and it's a lot more than that, not just in terms of length, but in terms of quality. You know, I think this is much more than just a short play. He actually wrote it as a short story 20 years before he wrote it as a screenplay. So in the mid-40s, he wrote a short story. 20 years later, he returned to the subject and produced the screenplay. And clearly Hollywood, you know, had absolutely no appetite for it, you know, given the subject matter, even though by then, you know, even though by the 60s, he was a theatrical giant and he had some sort of muscle. So the stage adaptation was 40 years later, and it was first put on by Steppenwolf in Chicago. But this version is a later version that was put on in New York. And this is its UK premiere. So the central character, as you say, Ollie Olsen, is a sailor. He's a boxing champion. And he loses his right arm in a car accident with some of his fellow sailors. He can't get work, and he's propositioned by a man in the New Orleans park, and that kind of takes him into this career as a male prostitute. He's never comfortable with that, and he's often repulsed by what he's doing. And the other thing that Moises Kaufman does, which apparently isn't in the original screenplay, is he does it in flashback from his death row cell. And apparently that is his innovation. The original screenplay didn't do that. And I think that actually works particularly well, even though we don't know why he's on death row until quite late in the play, quite properly. But in this cell, he's inundated with letters from his former clients. And then we go in flashback to sort of various points from the accident onwards, really. And I thought it worked very well as a story. You know, you wouldn't say it was as great as his greatest plays, but it's certainly better than any of his shorts. And he's better than some of his full-length plays. So I thought it was just much better than I was kind of expecting. Perhaps I'd sort of built my expectations down based on the Tennessee Williams shorts I've seen particularly recently. The production is outstanding, and in every respect, really. Josh Seymour's done a really, really good job. There's good movement. There's a good use of sort of sound. Tom Vary, who's really quite a young and inexperienced actor as Ollie, I thought was great. He's got a good accent, and he uses a bandage to kind of signify the lost arm. And then there are about another 21 characters who are played by just those four actors that you mentioned, and all four of them I thought were extremely good indeed. So I thought this was, I mean, I went along in a way as a bit of a Tennessee Williams collector, you know, a Tennessee Williams play I hadn't seen. And I was really bowled over by it because it was just so much better than that. So for me, it was a big treat, and it was one of two adapted screenplays by American playwrights I've seen this week, because I also went to see the Arthur Miller screenplay that's now The Hook in Northampton. And both were great, but this was a surprising treat, I think.
What do you think about it, Nick?
Yeah, I think this is a very strong production. I think it's interesting the way, because it's in the little, as the name suggests, the smaller space in Southwark Playhouse, I think it's unusual to see, for things not to feel really kind of very sort of intimate in there, but actually there's very little that feels physically close to the characters, and I think that's deliberate, because it feels to me, because I think it is a play about sort of emotional distance, and a lot of the action is kind of as far away from the audience as it could possibly be. And I think unusually that's something that works. You know, it's usually, you know, kind of losing intimacy would be a bad thing, but I think in this case you kind of very much get the impression that it's trying to give of him being a character who's really stepped back from his own emotions and from any kind of connection with people, and that's kind of got him in a way into the situation he's in when we meet him, and he's on death row. I agree. I think the restructuring of it in flashback is a really good idea, because it does sort of, you do see from the start these letters coming in, and I think they're a very important part of the story, because he has sort of distanced himself from the world, and I think these are kind of, you know, as he's kind of anticipating his life ending, he kind of finds that actually he's not been just kind of a piece of meat as he thinks he is. It's quite interesting the way the story deals with his disability, because it's actually treated as something that makes him more appealing as a rent boy. So I think it's kind of the fact that it becomes a fetish, and he kind of becomes little more than a fetish to the people who are to the clients is what makes him kind of feel as if all he is his disability and his, you know, his missing arm. So that's quite an interesting way of carving out that issue. I mean, there is a very strong cast. You've obviously got Joe Jameson in there, who anyone who's kind of regulars at the Globe and Sam Wanamaker will be familiar with him, and he's been doing good work for a long time, and he's very good in this as well, as are all the supporting cast. But I agree that, I mean, Tom Vare is the real find there, because he's somebody who's not, I don't think he's done any work in London before. I certainly haven't seen him, and I think he's done very little professional work. And he does kind of come straight in there as kind of a leading man and a really, really kind of intense performance. And yeah, and I agree, the accent again, I think we've had a good week for American accents. So I think it's interesting. I think it's pretty moving, especially at the end, as the themes of it all kind of come together and you start to see what the sort of shape of the story is. And yeah, it's, I mean, there's some, I pretty much on the same page with Gareth about Tennessee Williams. He's one of my favorite playwrights, but some of his more kind of experimental stuff and his shorts are often a bit more hard going, but this is one of the better kind of rarities out of his canon. So it's definitely, I mean, yeah, if you are a completist, you're going to go, but I think it's well worth seeing as a particularly strong Tennessee Williams play, and kind of, I think, as a lot of people have been saying, it's putting explicitly onto the stage, not so much with Ollie himself, but with the Johns, the clients, it kind of the stuff that's implicit in a lot of his male characters, who you can kind of see they're intended to be gay characters, but it's never actually spelt out why they kind of got that disconnect in their lives in his more famous plays. I think Brick in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is the example that most people would think of. And, you know, it's kind of these things of people, characters who we know are gay, but it's never dealt with quite as head on as it is with the various clients in this. So it's interesting also in terms of seeing a different side of kind of the whole side of the picture, seeing it from a different direction. So it's just generally recommended.
And so groundbreaking that I think if you took the screenplay today to Hollywood, you wouldn't get it made. You might get it made as an independent film, but I certainly think Hollywood still wouldn't make it today. And here we are sort of, you know, 40, 50 years on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I more or less thought the same about the screenplay all the way through. I just thought you couldn't get this made as a Hollywood film. The more you think about it, obviously there would be an independent side to this, but yes, you really couldn't see anybody doing this. It wouldn't be acceptable, and it almost makes you slightly smug that you can do this sort of thing in the theatre, which you simply can't do in films. You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.